All right, another reminder, we are continuing to accept offerings for Faith Bible Church. If you are inclined to apply in that area, just make your appropriate notation on your gift, and we will do that through next Sunday. Will be the last Sunday we will accept offerings for that in order to help them. All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship, rebound if necessary. And let's get back here now to the text as we have dealt with the issue, the subject of oppression under which people can suffer, which launched us in there to a review of the doctrine of suffering. And from here, Solomon essentially now uses verse 9 as a springboard, the subject of oppression, to deal with the larger issue of the wicked in general. Obviously, in the near context, the wicked in view would be those who have oppressed others. But I think he's using that, again, as a bit of a springboard to deal with the subject of the wicked in general and how we see their life worked out. And in this case, focusing on their death, their burial, and all of that. The verse is very difficult from a grammatical standpoint. I will tell you that straight out. And as you notice, my translation does not square at all with the New American Standard, because I think they've kind of missed the point of what's going on there. And oh, by the way, I got to check something out here. I found out that apparently somehow some of you don't have all the verses in your Bible. obviously, it can't be a problem with my citation. So I need to check back to before you, if you want to make a note in your doctrine of suffering, that F on the conclusions, Hebrews 4:17 and 18 apparently does not exist in some versions. So the believer will find the appropriate comforter. That should be 15 and 16. That's what it should be. Hebrews 4, 15 and 16. That's it. And also, too, with that, you could, the appropriate level, Hebrews 2, 17 and 18 also does deal with that text as well, with that subject. So change that to 2, 16 and 17, and then 4, 15 and 16. And that should do it for that. So by the way, if you do notice, I haven't told everybody this, I don't think, but if you do notice something in the notes that is not correct, whether it's in the exegetical notes or in doctrines, point it out either to me or to Rich, because after we go through these things, he makes the corrections for them finally, and then we post the final version on the internet, and he sends it back to me, and I save it for my file. So we're still actually, believe it or not, after I've gone over this thing 5, 6, 7, 8 times, we get one more shot at it in class, and then that's when the real mistakes show up, so hopefully. And then we can fix them and then put out, you know, quality work instead of the stuff I normally do. all right, let's deal here with the burial of the wicked now. Back to that. We're dealing with a subject here that, again, the subject is pretty readily understood, I think, that wicked people get away with stuff. And that's not unusual. I think they've missed the point in what they're getting at here. And part of the problem is here the pronouns are not readily identified sometimes. But I think I've got it figured out, at least at this point, of what's going on here. And he's talking about, just to read it in mind, so then I have seen the wicked buried. And others, I put that in parentheses because it just says they came in. And I supply the words to mourn them, and this deals with the people coming to the funeral. And the wicked is plural. While the wicked is plural, we understand that what Solomon is talking about is a category of people, but generally speaking, a funeral has one guest of honor, as you might call it. And it's not a multitude of wicked people being buried all at once. It's just one, generally speaking. And people come into this situation. They enter in. And they will depart from the holy place. Now, I don't have holy place capitalized in my translation because I don't think it's technical. And in the New American Standard, well, they don't have it capitalized either. I don't think this refers to the temple because, number one, you wouldn't have a funeral at a Jewish temple. not at the temple. That's not where funerals were held. In fact, dead bodies were unclean, recognized as unclean ceremonially. Anybody that came into contact with them was unclean. And so you would not take this around the priest at all. The priest would not. And in some cases, if I remember right in the Mosaic Law, I believe there's some deals in there where the priest can't even defile himself by going to the funeral of a near relative because this rendered him unclean and he could not perform his functions. So when you read the holy place here, I do not see this as the temple because this is not where a funeral would be held. And they will quickly choose to forget. They are the mourners, the people who are still alive. Clearly, the dead man doesn't forget anything. He doesn't remember anything. He doesn't forget anything. And so you have a couple of options here that have been advanced about this verse that, to me, neither of the options that I have seen sufficiently explains it. But I think understanding this as a general funeral scene, and what would we expect at a funeral scene? You expect the dead body, and you expect people to show up to mourn the dead body, and to listen to whatever message is given about the dead body. The person that used to be in that body, at any rate. And then people get up and leave and go home. And they forget all about it. They choose to forget in the city where they, now the wicked here is the they, I believe, in the city where they did this or did thus. So wicked people, and this is another one of those things that Solomon says, this is futility, this is absurdity, this is insane. Why? Because in a funeral situation with a wicked person, they're very often treated just like the righteous, or better. Because in many cases, they have the money, they have a lot of contacts, they have a lot of people who would show up to mourn them. Whereas the righteous, who may toil in relative obscurity and anonymity, may not have all that. They may not know as many people and have as many contacts, or be a mover and a shaker amongst the city and do all that. Well, let's get into it here. So then, I have seen the wicked buried. You have a wow here that introduces this with the prefix bait and then the adverb ken, K-E-N. Literally, in thus or in this manner, literally. In this manner, so then is fine, but as long as you understand what's going on here. I have seen is a cow perfect. Now this gets into Solomon's personal observations, I have observed. And so he's talking again about his observations in life, the kinds of things he has seen that he can bear witness to pretty readily. So I have observed wicked ones. They supplied the definite article here, which is fine because he's dealing with a specific category of people. To make it specific in the English does not, in my opinion, affect it. But again, the wicked ones would be a category of people out there that experience burial. One category of people. Obviously, the righteous ones would be another one. But he's focusing on the wicked. I have seen the wicked ones being buried, literally. It's a cal passive participle of caver. Q-A-B-H-A-R. And that word means exactly that. Now, some want to amend the text here. This is a verse where they want to make, in some cases, at least two emendations. And so they, in some cases, they call this metathesis, which is just a reversal of the letters in the word. So instead of kavar here, they read it as karav. They reverse the last two radicals in the Hebrew there. And by the way, the radicals are the big letters, like when you see Q, B, R. And then the vowel points are underneath it. And so now these are referred to as radicals. These are the vowel points. And in the original, in the Masoretic text, the vowel points are supplied, but in the originals, they were not likely there. So they reverse the radicals here and want to amend this to read something else. But I don't see, first, I don't see that there's any reason to do this because I think the context here is relatively plain. So I have seen the wicked being buried. And they came in. Wow, here, and some supply this here now as they refer this to the wicked. Well, first, again, the wicked is a category, but generally speaking, at a funeral, you got one wicked guy. You don't have a bunch of them. You have one wicked guy being buried out of that group of wicked people that lives out there. that he's died. And so I see the wow here, or the wow plus the count perfect here, and they came in. A bow, or they enter, would be the mourners, those who came to the funeral, wherever it was held. And it was not held at the temple. Again, there's no way it would have been there. But they had places set aside clearly. We don't know exactly, but from this text, it makes it seem clear to me anyway that they had places set aside for where they would observe this type of thing. Often today, it's held at a church or a funeral home, and then they retire to the graveside where they'll have another little part of the service. And so, culturally, I don't expect it to be wholly, completely different than that in Solomon's time. There isn't a lot of good isagogics on this as part of the problem. We don't know exactly what the burial traditions were. But we can look at, say, Abraham. He bought a burial plot. He buried his wife. He went through a period of mourning. There's nothing said about some public ceremony there, but let's face it, Abraham's situation was somewhat unique in that he was largely alone in that land and didn't have a lot. He was not friendly with the indigenous peoples in Canaan, so his service might have been obviously much smaller, if he did anything at all, other than go through whatever little ritual he might have liked. So they came in and they entered. And then you have in the text, and from the place of holiness. And from the place of holiness is a preposition, men, plus the word makom, which means place, M-A-Q-O-M. And then the word holiness is kadosh, Q-A-D-H-O-S-H. And from the place of holiness, again, the word holy here can mean holy, holy one, or holy place. But because it's coupled with this noun, the construct noun, it has to be holy place. And from the holy place, they will walk. I take the way, they will walk, they will depart as the mourners. They come in for the funeral, and they, you know, whatever the funeral situation was and the service entailed. And then after that, they leave, which to me fits very well here with what he's trying to get at. They want to make, in some cases, they want to make this day the same day as the wicked. Well, there's no way the wicked guy gets up and departs from his own funeral. No, I'm sorry, he does not walk anywhere. And I know halak means to depart, to go away, and all of that. So in some cases, they've translated this, and they died. That's one of the ways halak is used, is to walk, to depart, to go away. It's even used as a euphemism for death. H-A-L-A-K-H. And so they departed, they died. Well, the wicked, first they're being buried, so to me this does not fit. They already have died, unless they're burying some live wicked guy, and I don't think that's happening. So they're being buried. And the mourners come in, they hear the deal, and then they leave, as one would expect. And an important point here is, and they came in, Solomon kind of places himself at the funeral, we might say, for the sake of vividness. And they will depart is actually an imperfect. It's not a perfect. They didn't come in and they departed, as it were. He said they came in after the funeral, they will leave. They will depart. And then you have a wow plus another imperfect here, but this one's a hithpael of a shakak. S-H-A-K-H-A-C-H. Shakak, the verb, the cowl means to forget something or someone. We all have known that. We know what it means to forget. That's pretty readily understood. This is the only use of the hithpael in the Old Testament. The hithpael is the reflexive sim. So they forgot themselves or they caused themselves to forget. But the idea is they intentionally choose not to reflect on certain things. Why? Because this is what people say at funerals, right? Never speak badly of the departed. So they won't say anything bad about it. They're not even going to think anything bad about it. And I remember one time I was talking to Dan Brown when his dad died, and he said, you know, you went to the funeral and somebody walked out, you know, that was from Bible class, and they said, you know, it was just like he didn't have a sin nature. Well, yes, but guess what? He was just a fundy loser, unfortunately. While he was a nice enough guy, he didn't have anything on the ball spiritually. They made him sound like he was the greatest believer that had ever come down the pike. And he was a wonderful father and a great dad and a great believer, and he went to church and blah, 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 and he hardly ever attended, but we don't sponsor with that. We don't want to talk about that. Let's be quiet. Don't say anything bad about him. He's dead. So people tend to not want to remember the truth. And these people come into a funeral. They hear this glowing eulogy about how wonderful he is. And that's the best way to be popular is to die. Because then everybody will forget what a jerk you were and think, oh, man, oh, I remember we had this good time once. So here I view this hip pile as being a truly reflexive deal. They do it to themselves. They don't want to remember. They choose to forget. They choose to forget. In the city is inseparable. And this no doubt is where the funeral was held. I mean, typically speaking, when one dies, they're going to be buried in the city where they lived and all that. You're not going to, normally you wouldn't transport them large distances. I mean, obviously today people do that. But in that day, I mean, you didn't want to carry a dead body 5 or 6 days to the funeral place. The burial site. So they quickly forget in the city, among the inhabitants of the city. At the funeral, they forget about how bad this guy really was. In the city is an inseparable preposition, bait here, plus the word here, I-Y-R, city. In the city in which, relative particle, asher here, in which thus they did. And then you got a cal perfect, the shift. Now here back to the perfect from the imperfect. And I think the shift is because he's referring now back to the wicked guy who's died. And he did certain things in this city where he lived, certain wicked things that people know about. But at the funeral, they're not going to talk about him. They're going to ignore him. They're going to say he was a great believer. And surely, I remember when my dad died, and you know, my dad never went to church that I can remember. They got me up, you know, made me go as a kid. But he never went, and his excuse was, I can't stand those women screeching when they sing. Well, that's a good reason. I understand. But you've got to make me go sit there and listen to it. How fair is that? Not. But I went, you know, so I learned, you know, this little light of mine. Fun little songs, but I didn't know what they meant. They wouldn't go to church. And I remember when this Fundy Baptist got up and lied over my dad. Said, you know, surely there's a place in heaven. So how do you get a place in heaven? Oh, he's a good dad. Well, he was a good dad. I mean, he was a good parent. I don't have any problem with that. But his spiritual life was zippo. I don't even know if he was a believer or not. He never discussed it with me. And never went to church. And after a point, they didn't even make us go anymore. So, you know, I don't have any idea. But this Baptist gets up and just tells all these phenomenal stories. And I'm just thinking, you know, I knew the guy and I didn't know any of this. And some of it, I sit there, found myself offended that I was even hearing it. But that's the way it is. That's the nature of how funerals are. You don't get up and tell the truth. For God's sake, do not tell the truth about this wicked person. We got to make this nice. So they manufactured the city in which the wicked did their wickedness is what I think is in view here. The populace has a very short memory, as we've already been told about that. People have very short memories. They're going to forget about it. The future days, the next generation will forget what the previous generation did, who's already forgot what the previous generation did. And so people have a tendency, part of human experience is to focus on where you live now, here and now. So they quickly make themselves forget in the city in which they, the wicked, did thus. Indeed, also, even here you got an adverb, damn, used as emphatic, also, indeed. Additionally, this is it's also used, it means to add something additional to the thought. This is vanity, hevel, our term that we've had, you know, many times throughout this book. Verse 11, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men are fully, among them, are fully given to do evil. Which here now, The relative particle asher normally means that or which or who. But in this case, it appears to be introducing the protasis, the if clause, or the introductory clause in a statement. And here it's translated more in the sense of since. That this is kind of taken as a given, and it's true, we might say. So you can always translate that since or because. In a first-class condition, although the Hebrew does not, I recognize, it does not have conditional conditions like the Greek language did. But I know there, you know, there isn't truly genitives in Hebrew, but I recognize, you know, the terms apply, and interpreters use these regularly to recognize what's going on. So if and it's true, that the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, because there does not exist adverb, ayin, again, Solomon uses this to denote non-existence. There does not exist being done or being executed. You've got a niphal of asa, A-S-A-H, which means to make or do, to manufacture. The niphal is the passive stem, being done. They've translated it not executed. Not executed, and then the word sentence here is pithgan. P-I-T-H-G-A-N. And if one reads Hebrew or knows the Hebrew language, you'd recognize this word is strange in form. It definitely is. There are some Hebrew words with four radicals, but one, they're unusual. Normally, the Hebrew has three radicals or less. So this has four radicals, which one sets it apart. But number two, it's a Persian loan word, or at least that's what the interpreters tell you. My content, and see, this is why they want to make the date late for this book. They want to put it down around the time of the Persian conquest, the Persian captivity, or later. Because they say, well, this word must have been in existence before Solomon wrote it. My argument to these people is this. Number one, Solomon was a worldly wise man. Solomon had a lot of experience. A lot of people came from a lot of places to see and hear and talk to Solomon. And just even to see what was going on there. We know the Queen of Sheba did, for instance. And so, one, Solomon may have coined this term himself. Or number two, he may have come in contact with it from another culture. It wasn't as though the Persian culture did not exist at that time. They were not dominant, but they existed. And so, or at least, we might call the beginning stages of it. We know they were well in charge following the fall of Babylon. And that doesn't happen overnight. And continued to dominate until Greece took over. So the idea here is that my argument to these people would be, prove to me Solomon didn't coin this phrase, term rather, or prove to me he didn't hear it from somebody that came to visit from a foreign land. And they don't have an answer for that. So the word means a decision, an edict, a decree, even a judgment. It can refer to a verdict. In a trial, in a forensic sense. Most English versions consistently translate this word as denoting a sentence against a crime. That seems to be the consensus among interpreters and translators. And I don't see any reason here, I don't have enough proof to change that, to even argue with it, that seems to be what's in view here. So translate that word sentence, because the sentence is not being executed against a deed of the evil, literally, the evil deed. You have ma'aseh, which is a form of asa. It's a noun off of the verb to make or to do, A-S-E-H. And then you have the definite article plus ra'ah, evil, R-A-A-H. So against the evil deed, criminal activity, crimes against humanity, whatever that might be. And he's vague here. He leaves it open. With haste is the adverb here, mehera. M-E-H-E-R, H-E-R-A-H. This word means with haste, quickly, or speedily. So because sentence in the English version here is pretty good, it communicates, I think, what's in the Hebrew. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed with haste, quickly, in a timely fashion, we might say. Therefore, the hearts of the sons of men are fully set to do evil. Now, therefore, clearly introduces the apodosis here, the conclusion off of this. You've got the preposition ale plus the adverb ken. A-L-K-E-N. which means on account of this or therefore. Therefore, the heart, you got a collective singular here of Lev, it's not just one heart. The heart of the sons of men. Sons of men is the masculine plural noun construct of Ben, and then Adam. The sons of men equal mankind. That's the way he talks about this. He uses it. The hearts of the sons of mankind are filled. Calperfect of male, M-A-L-E apostrophe. And that word means exactly that, to be full or filled. We know, take a glass, you know what it means to fill it up. It's to something is completely occupied with something else, completely filled with it. The hearts of the sons of men are filled in them. You have kind of a redundancy here, but they've translated it among them, in them or among them, is the inseparable preposition bait plus the third masculine plural suffix. The hearts of the sons of men are full in them to do evil for the purpose of or for the intention of doing evil. You got the prefix lamed plus the cal infinitive construct of asa, again to do, to make, to manufacture. And then the adjective, masculine singular adjective of ra, R-A apostrophe, evil. And one of the principles we have here is that lack of judicial integrity and judicial speed. Let's see, didn't we have something that guaranteed us a right to a speedy trial at one time? I've heard about it. It doesn't really exist. I mean, trials take, how long did it take them to get R. Kelly to trial? A long time, years, to get him to trial. And then, of course, the goal of dragging the trial out is because then witnesses die, they forget things, they're not as clear on the facts and all that. So really, if you're a criminal, the best thing for you to hope for is a slow trial, not a quick one. And you definitely don't want a trial among your peers. You want a trial among a group of idiots is your best bet if you're a criminal. Hope for a really stupid jury. That would be your best bet. But the fact is, this isn't done quickly anymore. And Solomon's already bemoaned this. This is not new or unique to our culture. There's nothing new under the sun. Solomon says this was going on in his day, that these weren't being executed. Okay, well, point one here. Interpreters make no secret of the fact that verse 10 is as difficult to translate and interpret as any verse in the book of Ecclesiastes. Two, in order to ease the problems, a couple of textual emendations and other suggestions have been offered. However, neither really make the translation simpler or more understandable. The first emendation is changing the cal passive participle of kaver, to be buried, or being buried, to karav, that is to change to transpose the radicals, which means to draw near or approach by simply transposing the two last radicals. Now the reason they want to do that is they want to say here that the wicked went through religious motions, is kind of what they're trying to get at with that suggestion. They're saying that all this refers to the wicked. I've seen the wicked buried. I've seen the wicked drawing near, rather. And they come in and they will depart from the holy place. And it's talking about the wicked going through his religious motions in the temple, and there they make the holy place technical for the temple. I don't see that here, but that is at least one suggestion that they offer. So I am aware of it. I looked at it, but one, you have to amend the text, and there's no reason to at this point. Especially if one just simply understands what the rest of the verse is saying, that it's about a funeral setting. And it's not about people going through religious motions. Although, one might suspect that the wicked probably did this. They probably went through religious motions. They probably came in and did ritual without reality. No doubt they attended the temple. If they were good Jews living in a major city, they would have, in Jerusalem certainly. I got to assume that's where Solomon's talking about, because he said it's in the city where they lived. And if he's seen it, that's where he lived, was Jerusalem. I mean, not to say he never visited any other cities. So one, again, you transpose this, but this requires an emendation of the text, and I don't think it needs to be done. And there's no evidence that there's a textual issue here. B, the second major change is to read the verb shakak, to forget or to be forgotten, as shavak, to praise or commend. And but still the problem lies with that, is that it's still a Hithpile. And so then they would read it. The wicked ones were coming into the temple, as it were, and then departing, and they praised themselves. Well, so what, they patted themselves on the back for going through their religious motions? Well, maybe they did. But again, I don't see that you have to do that. And I think the text makes sense as it stands. So I reject both of these. The first, when they can't explain things, the first thing many liberal interpreters want to do is they want to change the text, because the text is too damn difficult. And it can't be this difficult. Yes, it can. But you got to be willing to plow through it, study through it, and think about it, rather than searching for an easy answer by, well, we'll just change the text to make it easier to understand. Well, that's not the way to go. Three, the phrase "the place of holiness" is very often interpreted to refer to the temple. And all this activity centers around the wicked and their comings and goings from the temple. For these changes would then mean that the wicked are drawing near, entering, ostensibly worshiping, leaving the temple and being praised for their supposed piety, or else boasting in their hypocrisy. But the problem with being praised for their piety, even if you make that change, is it doesn't account for the Hithpile. It doesn't account that it's reflective. That just makes it a mere passive. It would be a Niphal in that case. So again, while that is one way this is interpreted, and do people do all that? Well, sure. There are people that go through religious motions. There are people going through religious motions today. There's a whole bunch of them going through religious motions. A whole bunch of them, Catholics, go through religious motions on Saturday night so they can sleep in. Now, I like that. Maybe we'll change Bible class to Saturday so we can sleep in. No, we can't, but not here anyway. But at any rate, the point is, people do this. They go through religious motions. We understand. There's a lot of ritual out there without reality. Even among people who claim to be positive, there's a lot of ritual without reality. As they blow off certain doctrines and do their things, and they keep going through their religious motions. Some people just blow it off and just say, to hell with it, I'm not even bothering. That's one approach. Others, they go back to being fundies. They go back, they hold to some inferior form of doctrine. They find some quasi-doctrinal teacher who'll put up with their nonsense. And then they follow him. But again, that gets into the having itching ears syndrome. So again, people do this, but I don't think to me this doesn't explain it all. And it doesn't account for the text itself. So five, others see the verse as presenting a contrast between the wicked being buried and the righteous, who are quickly forgotten following their lives. Now, is that true? Sure. That does happen. Wicked people may get a great funeral and a big send-off and all that, right into hell. But the righteous are quickly forgotten and maybe toiled in anonymity and are buried in anonymity at some level. But there's a couple of problems with that. A, those that see the entire verse referring to the wicked do not take into account the shift from the perfect tense of the first verb to the imperfect tense of the following two verbs. That, to me, is critical, because it's talking about incomplete action in the imperfect. We usually translate it like it's a future. They will do thus and such. But the imperfect is not just simply strict future. And if you really want to be bored to tears, I'll give you all my notes on the imperfect and the way it can be used along with the perfect. And if you can get through them without falling asleep, then you're a great believer. But it can be used in a lot of ways, but we tend to view it at first, the root meaning is incomplete action. So my deal here, how can you say the wicked have incomplete action? They're dead. They're being buried, for God's sake. I'm pretty sure they're not doing anything. Let's open the coffin and see. Maybe he's in there doing something. Who knows? No, I don't think so. So that's a problem. That's one of the things they don't account for here when they do this. Secondly, and I also recognize that this is relatively difficult at this point. I understand this isn't easily stuff to get your mind around. But hopefully, once we get through this, you can see what's going on. Secondly, the use of the Hithpile stem for the verb forgotten cannot possibly refer to the wicked, who are already dead and can do nothing for or to themselves. It is a reflexive. And we wouldn't translate it this way, but like, you know, I bathed myself. That's a reflexive. We would say, you know, I took a shower or whatever. Or I took a bath. But it's truly reflexive. You're not only the one doing the action, you're the one that's participating in it as well. So, and that's the whole point of a reflexive, is it's something one does to or for themselves. Well, I don't see that the wicked can do it. The dead people can't do anything to or for themselves. They're just being buried. That's all they're doing. And then see, those that see a change of subject from the righteous to the or from the wicked to the righteous are faced with the very obvious fact that the righteous are not even introduced in this section until verse 14. And if you look ahead to verse 14, there is a futility done on the earth. That is, that there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. But in some cases, while that's kind of true, maybe at a funeral, you might say, well, the wicked get a really great funeral, a nice send-off and all that, like the righteous should get, but they don't. Well, the deal is here, unfortunately, we're back in verse 10. The righteous aren't even introduced until verse 14. So I don't see them as being a part of this verse here. He's just simply talking, I think, pretty straightforwardly about a wicked man being buried and the things that go along with that. The types of things that one expects, mourners coming in, a funeral, whatever, however they did it, whatever the service was, and then they depart and then they forget about it. And that's human nature. And Solomon says this, is, and they quickly forget about how evil, how wicked these people really were. Because, you know, when they die, they get up and they praise them and all, and everybody forgets. Now, for those of you who are, you know, alive during this time or conscious, if you remember when President Kennedy got killed, everybody knows where they were when they heard about it, you know. And President Kennedy got killed, and everybody went into shock and all that, and they had this great procession. And what's the image everybody remembers? Little John saluting. Let's not worry about the fact that he was a womanizer and involved with organized crime and all these other things, and a part of a much other evil. Hey, he was a good guy. And so what do people remember? Very little. And what they do remember isn't significant about what the life of the man was actually really about. So that's the nature of people. They quickly forget. Well, 7 here, grammatically, the verse begins with an unusual construction that is used only one other time in the Old Testament. And it's used, actually, in Esther 4:16. And actually, you know, as I remember right, and if I remember right, you will not see it in the English here. It doesn't really show up, as it were, there in that verse. Because you can read it in English, and you're thinking, well, which word is it? I can't tell you. But that's where it is used in Esther 4:16. So 8, it is comprised of a wow with a prefix bait and an adverb ken, which is designed to relate to what has just been stated about one man using his authority to oppress another. This verse in 10 links back, and while it may not be evident on the surface, grammatically it links back to verse 9, that he's talking here about the wicked, and generally speaking, the thought of the wicked comes out of this oppressor situation. 9, the repetition of the verb ra'ah, which means to see, I have seen. The wicked buried also serves to link to verse 10, to link verse 10 and what follows with the content of verse 9, because in verse 9 he used that very same verb as well. All this I have seen and applied my deal. And he says, okay, and I continue to see certain things that reinforce this in my thinking, that people can get away with their oppression. And when they die, guess what? They're treated as great people. So 10, the oppressor from verse 9 leads Solomon to note that all types of wicked people die and are given a proper burial, their wickedness or oppression notwithstanding. So that is true, and I mean, our human experience would tell us this is true, even if Solomon didn't say it. We would say that no matter what people are, and to the extent nowadays where you can plan out your own funeral ahead of time, you can make sure that you have a great funeral. I don't care how evil you are. You can have a great casket, you can make every arrangement in advance, you can have tons of flowers, you can hire professional mourners if you want to, if you're inclined. Well, 11, it would seem that the specific class of wicked men in view are those that have used their position of authority to oppress their fellow man. That's the springboard here. Obviously, there are more types of wicked people out there than just that. But that seems to be the springboard for his thoughts about this subject. Psalm 82, 1 through 4. God takes his stand in his own congregation. Once again, here, even a recognition in the Old Testament, much as we have in the New Testament, that the local church is God's household. That the adjusted believers at that time that constituted true Israel were God's congregation. Now, obviously, they had wicked people and all that in them. But it's his. It's his household. He judges in the midst of the rulers. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Vindicate the weak and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them out of the hand of the wicked. And God says, essentially, you know, this is one type of oppression that goes on out there. People do not use their positions of authority for the good of others. They use it to oppress people. And that's not appropriate. In 12, Solomon has already noted the fact that oppression is a feature of life, to which one will eventually be exposed, as he has warned his younger readers. And there's a verse here coming up in chapter 9, which suggests to me that his target audience was male younger readers. Not to say that females could not read this and profit from it. But it was younger male readers, as one would expect, giving, you know, fatherly examples and advice to the next generation. Ecclesiastes 5:8, if you see the oppression of the poor and the denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight. This is something I want to prepare you for, as any good leader who has some experience would want to do for those who he's trying to help, is let me prepare you for some of the unfortunate things that you're going to see in this life. And these are realities, and you're never going to get away from them. They exist. They're real. You're going to see it. Don't be shocked when you see it. This kind of thing happens all the time. And even in spite of the fact that in the establishment chain of command, there are people that are above them and above them and above them. That these people tend to, once a person gets entrenched, we see this in our society, once a person gets entrenched in a governmental job, do they give it up readily? Oh, no. Hell no. Are you kidding me? I mean, I am feeding at the public trough. I am a congressman with free haircuts, free health insurance, free this, free that. I'm treated and wined and dined by people who want to, you know, buy my vote on certain matters, or pass legislation that's favorable to them. Why would I ever want to walk away from that? This explains why you'll spend $10 million to get elected president that pays $200,000 a year. Or maybe they raised it, I don't remember, but it was $200,000 a year. But nobody in corporate America would do that. Nobody in corporate America would spend $10 million to get a job as a CEO of a company that paid $200,000. I mean, how many years would you have to be CEO just to break even? Well, let's see, 5 years is a million times 10. They have to be 50 years in that job just to break even. So clearly they're not doing it for the money. So why are they doing it? Well, obviously they like the position, they like the power, they like all that goes with it. In many cases, it is approbation and power lust. So when you see this, again, as he warns his younger readers, this is going to be a fact. And he acknowledges this once again. There's these oppressors. There's those people who use their position in the establishment chain of command to do wrong to others. Not because they're trying to do right, because they're trying to do wrong. And so don't be shocked when you see it. Well, 13, the fact that injustice and oppression occurs is disturbing enough. However, it can become even more distressing when it occurs and there is no apparent retribution for those that have engaged in oppression. Evil men, negative people, seem to get away with what they do. That's kind of the whole argument of this book at some level. As you look at life, it seems that people do not get what they deserve. It seems that on the surface, they can be very evil, very wicked, engaged in all kinds of stuff, and blowing off all kinds of doctrines. And do you see God punishing them? Then sometimes you see this flash where suddenly somebody pays the price for their stupidity. And you think to yourself, oh yeah, okay, God's still, he's definitely still watching. But for, you know, it may go by a year, 2 years, 5 years, however long. And it appears that people have gotten away with their idiocy. and their abuse and their evil. And there you go. So again, it's disturbing enough, but when you don't see it being righted, that's very troubling for the positive believer, I think, at some level. Solomon was troubled by it. We would like to see this accurate and quick and perfectly just retribution that comes on people, that they ought to pay the penalty for their evil. But we don't. We don't see that. And that contradicts, at some level, what we believe about God. Because we believe God is righteous and just. But then you have to factor in God's patience to all of this. God is righteous and just, and why is God moving, theoretically, from our perspective sometimes, so slow? Well, he's tired. He's been God for a while. Do you know how hard it is being God? I mean, think about it. You have to run a whole world. God obviously never gets tired. So why is he slow? Well, we're told in 2 Peter there. God is not slow, as some people consider slowness. But he is patient towards people, giving them a chance to change their mind. And so for the negative unbeliever out there, he's got this day and how many ever more God provides to change his mind. For the negative believer who's rejected doctrine, he's got this day and how many ever more God provides to get his act together and to return to that which will save his soul. Because other than that, he's a casualty. And he's going to lose out at the Bema seat. So we would expect God to do this. But why doesn't he do it? Well, one reason, God is patient. And Solomon never alludes to that in this book. He never brings that up. What he is concerned with is what we see that troubles us. And he goes through all of this, and he essentially says there are these many, many, many troubling things in life. And yet, I am convinced that it'll be well for God and for those who fear him openly. But everything in our kind of experience says, well, that's not necessarily true. But yeah, that's true. That's the verse we need to apply faith towards. It will be well for God. Yet, and he uses that. He actually uses it as kind of a contrast. Though the wicked man, they may do thus and such. I know. His doctrinal grid tells him that God is for the righteous, and while you may not see it, and while it may not be manifest at all times, that he will make it right. That it is going to be well for them in the long run. Some people take a very short view of this deal. But again, as we've told you, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. Life goes on. People want to look towards the short view. I'm doing what I want right now, and I'm getting away with it. Okay, that's the short view. You may be. But will it work out long term? Solomon's answer to you would be no, it will not. If you're not doing it God's way, it's not going to work out long term. Even as difficult as it is doing it God's way in this world. We just finished the doctrine of suffering. You're going to suffer. It's difficult down here. And it'll remain difficult down here. Guess what? Still long term. And I think that's another thing kind of subtly behind all this book, is you need to look at the big picture. You need to look at what is unseen. What is unsaid in this book? Solomon, that I know of, and I'm working in chapter 9 right now, but Solomon never flat out comes out and says, look, God is for the righteous, he's going to make this all A-okay, and ultimately there'll be an eternal judgment in which all this will be squared away. He never comes out and explicitly declares that. Although he alludes to it from time to time. And my feeling is that's what Solomon believed, that you need to take the long view of things. And the long view is that you factor God into it, rather than trying to do it your way. That's the long view. Okay, well, our time is up. Let's just stop there, and we will continue on here Wednesday, God willing. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God, the Holy Spirit, sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.